If I say the word Epicurean to you right now, just be honest. What is the very first image that pops into your head?
That's easy. I'm picturing like a five-course meal.
Right.
White tablecloths, maybe a really expensive bottle of vintage red wine. Just total sensory indulgence.
Exactly. The whole foodie lifestyle.
Yeah.
It's luxury, it's excess, it's treating yourself. And I mean, that is exactly what I thought before I opened up this stack of source material we're looking at today for this deep dive.
It's funny how that
But
happens.
the very first thing these texts do is just completely shatter that image.
It really is probably one of the biggest branding failures in the history of philosophy.
It has to be, because the mission for us today is to dig into what these ancient philosophers, the Epicureans and their cousins, the Cyrenaics and the Cynics, were actually talking about.
Right, the real story.
And it turns out the original Epicureans were arguably some of the most disciplined, kind of anxiety-ridden and ascetic people in the ancient world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They weren't eating grapes on a chaise lounge. They were obsessing over atomic physics and trying to cure the human soul of terror.
That's the key right there. We are looking at the so-called Socratic schools.
Oh.
But these aren't the guys you usually hear about in an intro to philosophy class, like Plato or Aristotle.
Right.
These are the rebels, the outcasts.
The punks of the ancient world.
They really were.
Yeah.
And we have three distinct flavors here to unpack for you. We've got the Cyrenaics, who were chasing extreme, immediate pleasure.
The extremists.
Exactly. Then we've got the Epicureans, who were trying to, well, basically hack the physics of the universe to find peace.
And then
And then the Cynics, who just decided to reject civilization entirely and bark at people in the street.
literally bark. And the thing that connects them all, and our sources make a really big deal of this, is that they all started from the exact same place.
That's the
Socrates.
irony of it. They all read the same prompt. Socrates famously said, "Know thyself." For Socrates, that meant, know your soul so you can be a virtuous person. But these groups, particularly the Cyrenaics, took that instruction in a wildly different direction.
Let's start there, actually. The Cyrenaics. They look at know thyself and they say, okay, what do I actually know about myself? I don't know the secrets of the cosmos. I know that I like feeling good.
It's the total shift from morality to physiology. The founder of the school, Aristippus, basically argued that we can't really know anything about the outside world for sure.
Which makes sense.
Right. The only thing I can be 100% certain of is my own internal sensation. I know if I'm in pain, and I know if I'm feeling pleasure.
So it's almost an epistemological stance. Since I
Yeah.
can't know the truth with a capital T, I should just focus on the sensation with a capital S.
Precisely. And that leads to what they call egoistical hedonism. They believe the ultimate good in life is pleasure.
And not just hanging out with friends.
No, they weren't talking about happiness in a long-term, fulfilling career sort of way. They
Yeah.
meant intense, immediate physical pleasure. Right here, right now.
The sources describe it as wanting the maximum pleasure of the maximum intensity and the maximum immediacy. It's like the ancient Greek version of YOLO. You only live once, so grab the sensation right now.
It is very much that energy. They believe that good and bad are just labels we slap onto our nerve endings.
Oh.
If a sensation is smooth and gentle, it's good. If it's rough and violent, it's bad. There's no moral law in the sky judging you. There's just your body telling you what it wants.
And here's where the deep dive gets really dark, really fast. This pursuit of intense pleasure hits a wall, a totally logical wall. And that wall has a name, Hegesias.
Ah, Hegesias. He is a fascinating figure. He's a Cyrenaic, completely committed to the idea that pleasure is the absolute goal of life.
Right.
But he's what happens when you do the math on hedonism and you happen to be a pessimist.
He's the buzzkill of the ancient world.
He really is. Hegesias looked at the human condition and said, okay, if the goal is pleasure, we have a massive problem because life is inherently difficult. You have sickness, you have heartbreak, you have poverty.
The pain column is almost always going to be taller than the pleasure column.
Exactly. We can never produce a surplus of pleasure. We're
Sorry.
basically always operating at a deficit.
And if you're a strict hedonist like the Cyrenaics, and you realize you can't actually win the game,
What's the rational move?
you quit the game.
You quit. Hegesias argued that since positive happiness is impossible to sustain, the only rational goal is the total absence of pain. And the only way to guarantee zero pain is to end your life.
The text actually calls him the Counselor of Suicide. That is such a heavy title.
And it wasn't just theoretical either. The source mentions he was actually a teacher in Alexandria, and the local government had to ban him from lecturing.
Because his students kept taking his advice.
Yeah. They were actively listening to him.
That is such a grimly humorous detail. He was so persuasive that he was literally firing his own customers. But I think it's a crucial insight for us. It shows that unbridled hedonism, this obsession with feeling good constantly, is actually incredibly fragile. If you live for the high, the low just destroys you.
It's a boom and bust economy for the soul. It's not sustainable at all. And that fragility is exactly what the next group, the Epicureans, tried to fix.
Which brings us to the upgrade. This is where we move from the Cyrenaics to the much more famous Epicureans. They look at the Cyrenaics and say, okay, you guys have the right idea. Pleasure is the good, but you're doing it all wrong.
Exactly. This is the shift from the short game to the long game. We have Epicurus in Greece, and later on, the Roman poet Lucretius. They are still hedonists, technically, but their definition of pleasure is completely flipped.
Right. They introduce this concept of ataraxia.
Ataraxia. It's often translated as tranquility, but literally it means freedom from pain in the body and trouble in the soul.
So if the Cyrenaics want the intensity of the high, the Epicureans just want to avoid the hangover.
That is the perfect distinction. And the sources point at something really fascinating about Epicurus himself. There's a theory that he suffered from chronic stomach ulcers.
Which completely recontextualizes everything, doesn't it?
It really does. Think about it. If you are living with chronic pain, pleasure doesn't look like a giant feast or a wild party. Pleasure looks like a Tuesday afternoon where your stomach simply doesn't hurt. It changes your entire baseline.
So for the Epicureans, pleasure isn't about adding positive sensation. It's about subtracting negative sensation. It's a negative definition of happiness.
Yes. And they distinguish between quantitative pleasure and qualitative pleasure. The Cyrenaics were all about quantity. How much, how fast. Epicurus says, no, we need to look at quality.
The source used a great analogy here that really stuck with me. It posed a question, how do you compare the pain of a dentist drilling a tooth with the pain of a jilted lover?
Right. You can't put those on a spreadsheet.
You really can't.
One is physical, one is mental. One is very short, one lasts for months. So Epicurus argues that mental pleasures and mental pains are actually far more significant than physical ones.
Because the body only suffers in the present moment. If I stub my toe, it hurts right now. But the mind. The mind can suffer about the past, the present, and the future all at exactly the same time.
Exactly. Anxiety is the ultimate pain because it's limitless. You can worry about things that haven't even happened yet. So the Epicurean strategy is to pursue higher quality pleasures that don't carry the risk of anxiety. Things like friendship, education, reasonable discussion.
Smooth pleasures.
Smooth is the key word. And this is where we have to get into the weird science of it all. Because when they say smooth, they aren't being poetic or metaphorical. They're talking about literal physics.
This was the part of the deep dive that really surprised me. I honestly didn't expect a lecture on atomic theory when I signed up for a discussion on ancient happiness.
Right.
But the source says you cannot understand Epicurean ethics without understanding their physics.
It's foundational. You can't separate them at all. They were materialists. They followed the atomism of Democritus. They believed the entire universe consists of only two things, atoms and the void, particles and empty space.
Nothing comes from nothing.
Correct. No creator God, no divine plan, just eternal atoms falling through the void. And they believed that everything we experience, like color, taste, sound, those aren't real properties of the objects.
Those are what they call secondary qualities.
Right. The apple isn't actually red. The apple is just a bunch of atoms with a certain shape and size.
Yeah.
The redness happens when those atoms interact with your eye.
The source actually explains their theory of vision, and it is, well, it's very creative. They believed objects are constantly shedding these little skins or films.
Yeah, like a snake shedding its skin, but continuously. These little atomic outlines, they call them eidola, they fly through the air, shrink down, and physically enter your pupil. That's how we see.
It sounds kind of ridiculous to us now, obviously. But you have to respect the effort. They were trying to explain the world completely mechanically without resorting to magic or spirits.
And there's huge reason for that. They weren't just doing science for the sake of science. They were doing it specifically to cure anxiety.
But how does knowing about atoms cure anxiety? That seems like a pretty big leap.
Well, think about what people in the ancient world were afraid of. They were terrified of the gods. They were terrified of fate. They were terrified that if they stepped out of line, Zeus would strike them down with a lightning bolt.
Right. The world was just full of invisible, angry monsters.
But if the world is just atoms bouncing off each other, the monsters disappear. The thunder isn't Zeus being angry. It's just clouds bumping together. It removes the fear of the supernatural.
But there's a catch here, isn't there? If everything is just atoms falling in a straight line, completely dictated by the laws of physics, doesn't that mean we have no free will? If my brain is just atoms, aren't my thoughts just chemical reactions that were destined to happen anyway?
That is the danger of materialism. Determinism. But this is exactly where the Epicureans introduced their most famous concept. The swerve. The Lucretian swerve.
It sounds like a dance move from the 60s. Let's all do the swerve.
It does, but it's actually a cosmic loophole. Lucretius argues that as atoms fall through the void, occasionally, at totally unpredictable times and places, they swerve slightly from their course.
The source compares it to a baseball pitch that curves.
Exactly. And that swerve does two really important things. First, it causes atoms to collide and stick together, which is how we get stars and planets and people. But secondly, and more importantly for us, it introduces indeterminacy into the universe.
It breaks the chain of cause and effect.
Yes, because the atoms can swerve unpredictably. The human mind, which is made of atoms, can also swerve. It creates the physical space for free will.
That is wild. They were trying to find a quantum physics explanation for freedom 2,000 years ago.
They were. They absolutely needed a physics that allowed them to be in control of their own happiness. If you're just a robot made of meat, you can't choose ataraxia. You need that swerve.
Speaking of things we can't control, we have to talk about the biggest fear of all, death. The Epicureans used this atomic theory to tackle the fear of death head on.
This is the core of their therapy. They believe the soul is entirely physical. It's made of the smoothest and roundest atoms.
Like a bag of smooth marble.
Basically. When you feel peace, the marbles are rolling nicely. When you feel pain, rough atoms are tearing at you. But because the soul is physical, when the body dies, the container breaks, the atoms disperse, the soul simply ceases to exist.
Now, to most people, hearing your soul ceases to exist sounds terrifying.
Yeah.
But the Epicureans said, no, this is the good news.
It is the ultimate good news for them. Their argument is very simple. If we are, death is not. If death is, we are not.
You can never actually meet death.
You can't. It's physically impossible. You won't be there to experience the darkness or the silence. There is no afterlife. There is no judgment. There's no hell.
So all that anxiety about, did I live a good enough life or will the gods punish me? It's all wasted energy.
It's all a superstition to them. Lucretius wrote his massive poem, The Nature of Things, specifically to liberate people from this fear. He thought religion was the root of human misery because it terrorized people with threats of eternal punishment.
So if you accept the physics, you achieve ataraxia. You realize you are just temporary stardust, so you might as well enjoy a nice conversation and a piece of cheese while you're here.
A very sensible, quiet, garden-based life.
But I do have to play devil's advocate for a second. If there's no God, no afterlife, and no cosmic judge, why be good? What's stopping an Epicurean from robbing a bank or harming someone if they think they can get away with it?
That is the classic question. And their answer is shockingly modern. They didn't believe in justice with a capital J. They believed in a contract.
Conventionalism.
Yes. They said justice is just an agreement, an expediency that we make with each other. Mm. I agree not to hit you, and you agree not to hit me. Not because hitting is inherently evil, but because neither of us wants to get hit.
It's purely practical.
Purely. And the reason you don't rob the bank isn't because it's a sin. It's because if you rob the bank, you will live in fear of getting caught.
And fear destroys ataraxia.
Bingo. The source quotes them saying, injustice is bad because of the terror excited by apprehension. If you're a criminal, you're constantly looking over your shoulder. You can't relax. So you follow the law, not to please the gods, but literally to keep your own blood pressure down.
It anticipates Thomas Hobbes by centuries. The idea that society is just a deal we make to keep us safe from each other.
It's a very pragmatic, slightly cynical, but very effective way to view the world.
Okay, so that's the Epicureans. Seek smooth pleasures, understand physics so you don't fear the gods, and keep your head down so you don't get in trouble.
But then we have the cynics.
The cynics. If the Epicureans are the introverts hiding in their walled garden, the cynics are the guys screaming at you in the subway station.
That is a highly accurate description. The source introduces us to Antisthenes in the famous Diogenes, and they are part of a back-to-nature movement, but not in a cute, let's-go-camping-on-the-weekend kind of way.
No. They believe that civilization itself was the sickness.
Right. They looked at the Epicureans and said, you're still too dependent on things. If you need friends and cheese and a garden to be happy, you're vulnerable. The cynics wanted to be invulnerable.
And to be invulnerable, you have to need nothing.
Nothing at all. They live it like animals. In fact, the word cynic comes from the Greek word koun, which literally means dog. They were the dog philosophers.
And Diogenes totally embraced that. He lived in a large ceramic jar. basically a bathtub right out on the street. He'd beg for food. He mocked people walking by.
He rejected every social convention, manners, property, shame. He thought those were all invisible chains that society uses to enslave us.
There is that legendary story in the source material about Diogenes and Alexander the Great, and I think this sums up the entire philosophy better than any lecture ever could.
It's honestly one of the best moments in history. You have Alexander, the conqueror of the known world, the man who has absolutely everything. He hears about this famous philosopher living in a tub, and he goes to visit him.
He stands over him, probably blocking the sun, and says, "I am Alexander the Great. Is there anything I can do for you?"
He's offering him riches, power, cities, anything he wants. And Diogenes just squints at him and says, "Yes, get out of my life.
You're blocking my sun."
It is the ultimate power move. He's telling the most powerful man on earth, "You have nothing that I want. And actually, right now, you are annoying me."
It completely flips the script on what wealth actually is. Alexander has the whole world, but he's still anxious, he's still conquering, he's still needing more. Diogenes has a tub and a single ray of sunshine, and he is perfectly content. So who is the real master in that situation?
Exactly. The cynics believe that if you strip away everything, reputation, money, comfort, you find a kind of raw freedom that no one can ever take away from you.
And interestingly, the text mentions that this hardened, tough-as-nails attitude eventually evolves. The cynic ethics mix with the physics of Heraclitus, this idea of fire and logos, and that eventually gives birth to Stoicism.
Which is a deep dive for another day, but you can clearly see the lineage there. The Stoics took that cynic toughness and made it just a bit more socially acceptable.
So when we step back and look at these three schools for you today, Cyrenaics, Epicureans, Cynics, what's the big picture takeaway here?
I think the source material nails it with this one specific line. It says, a certain kind of metaphysic often leads to the same kind of ethic.
Meaning, how you think the universe works determines exactly how you think you should live.
Right. If you believe the world is just atoms and void, just material stuff, you inevitably end up with a hedonistic ethic. Because if this life is all there is, why wouldn't you try to make it pleasant?
It makes me wonder about us today. We live in a very scientific age. We accept atoms, we accept biology, we generally accept the materialist view of the world. Are we all just accidental Epicureans?
I think we are. We seek comfort. We try to minimize pain. We view justice as a contract to keep us safe. We might not wear togas, but we are definitely living in Epicurus's garden.
Just with much better dentistry.
Much better dentistry, which, as we learned, is a very high quality pleasure.
So a final provocative thought for you to take away today. Maybe the real goal is to find your own ataraxia, whether that's cultivating a deep conversation, enjoying a lack of stomach pain, or just telling someone to get out of your sunlight.
Whatever keeps your atoms flowing smoothly.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
A pleasure.